in that. And I don't blame Pastor for wanting to go down to the kids. My wife does a great job down there. And I want to encourage you, if you have a neighbor kid or somebody that you think, or somebody that's ridden the bus or whatever, the van, then you can certainly invite them. If you need to give them transportation, I would certainly encourage you to do that. But they'll be doing that every time there'll be enough kids. My wife is more than happy to. She loves to do it, actually. And I think so. I'm prejudiced, but I think she does a great job. So so I just want to remind you of that. She has all kinds of things going down there. She'll give the gospel. She will has some recorded puppet shows back when our kids used to travel with us. So she's got those recorded so she can still do the puppet shows. And she'll do all kinds of lessons and Bible stories. And it will be, it's not just babysitting down there. I'm just saying that she'll try. Just going to be giving some truth, teaching different songs on different things. And it'll be a profitable time. So I want to encourage you about that. So let's go to Ephesians chapter number 4. Ephesians chapter number 4. And I want to walk through a passage of Scripture, and time-wise here, we'll try to do the best we can here. Since it's Sunday night, we started sooner. That means we can go later. What do you think? Okay, so try to give you what's your money's worth here tonight. But I want to deal with something that I have, I don't know how to explain this, but I have just been awakened to. And I recognize, I suppose you do too, that we're living in a culture that is fast disintegrating. And as a result of that, a lot of times homes, a lot of dysfunction in them, a lot of things going on, a lot of hurt. And I want to deal with a passage of Scripture that might help us understand, number one, in our own lives, maybe we need to kind of get a perspective here, but also help you in helping others. So we're going to look at verse number 26 of chapter number 4, and deal with, first of all, a couple of verses. We'll walk down through the passage, and let's see what the Bible has here. It says, "Be ye angry, and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath," and here it is, "neither give place to the devil." Now, if I had 10 commentaries on the book of Ephesians, I were to read what the Bible, what they said about the Bible verse 26, you'd probably have 5 different interpretations. What in the world does the Bible mean when it says, "Be ye angry and sin not"? A lot of different takes on it. I'm going to give you mine. Of course, I think it's right. I don't know if you know. My dad used to have a saying. I thought it was great. And you probably can relate with this. He said, "You know, Jim, everybody's wrong in their theology somewhere. Nobody's perfect on it. I mean, everybody has a certain percentage of the theology that's wrong, some more than others, but everybody is wrong about something, except for me." Okay, now, you know, that's the way we feel about it, because obviously we're not going to believe something we think is wrong. We believe something we think is right. So I'm going to give you my take here on verse number 26. Being angry is actually, in the Greek language, passive in voice. It's hard to translate that. Being angered, okay, would be how you do that, but that kind of is awkward. So I have obviously believe this is a good translation, be angry. But you've got to think, what does that mean, okay? Well, that would simply mean, seems to mean, is when you're the passive recipient of someone else's anger that provokes you to anger. So in when it says be angry, it's the idea of being provoked to anger. So what is God's, really the emphasis is, God is saying this, I believe, when you're provoked to anger, don't sin. Now, I want to ask you a question. Anybody ever made you mad? Anybody ever provoked you like, man, that just makes me so mad? Here's what God says. When you and I are provoked to anger, we're just going through life, and we're the passive recipient of provocation. It's not our fault. We didn't go to be provoked. But all of a sudden, we're provoked. God says you're in a very precarious situation because it's really easy to sin at this point. Have you ever found that? Sure, when you and I are angered upon, I could say, or we're provoked to anger, it is a very vulnerable time because it's really easy to sin. It's not hard at all to mouth off. It's not hard to say something sarcastic. It's not hard to return with angry words with angry words. That's easy. So God is simply saying, I believe here, when you and I are provoked to anger, the emphasis is on don't sin. Deal with it. Okay, now, let's talk about it, this, because we're going to deal with this in a moment, but let's just stop for a moment. And what is it that often provokes us to anger? Let me just tell you this. I thought about this, and there's more applications in this, but this is certainly one of them. And I'll tell you what provokes you to anger. Pain. I want to ask all of you a question. I'm going to ask just the men, okay, because you ladies are much better at this than the men are. So I'm going to ask the men to be painfully honest. Will you be honest with me? Okay, men, how many of you have ever banged your head on the cabinets? Banged your head on the cabinets. Okay, how many of you, after you banged your head on the cabinets, the next thing you wanted to do, you didn't do it, But the next thing you wanted to do was rip the cabinets off the wall and destroy them. Raise your hand, ladies. Yeah. Now, isn't that odd? Isn't that really odd? Pain's a very interesting thing. Somebody has said this, hurting people hurt people. Wow, that's true, isn't it? When people get hurt, you know what they often do? They lash out with hurt. If you don't believe that, just go to the playground, okay? And wait till somebody hurts somebody, and you're going to see that that hurting person is going to try to hurt somebody else. Okay, it's just, it's human nature. It's our fallen nature. So God is simply saying, when you and I are provoked to anger, and pain is one of those things that provoke anger, you're at a very vulnerable spot because there's a good chance of sins. God is commanding us. When you and I are angered, where we are provoked to anger, we get angry because somebody provokes us to anger, God says, don't sin. Then he says something that's really interesting. He says, let not the sun go down upon your wrath. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Probably a couple of years ago, I was in a church, and I wish I could remember things about this, but I don't remember all the details. But I remember somebody came to me and said, Brother Ben Gilbert, you need to listen to this brain scientist, this lady. She's a brain scientist, not a brain surgeon. She's a brain scientist, and she lectures on the brain, and you need to listen to her. And so they said, I listened to an hour-long lecture, and it was actually very easy to listen to. It was riveting. But in that lecture, here's what she said. If you ever go to bed angry, something chemically alters in your brain. I thought, isn't that interesting? Now, don't get me wrong. I don't need brain science to believe that when God says, don't let the sun go down upon your wrath, that's enough for me to realize something bad happens if you and I go to bed angry. But she gave the physiological part. Now, I understand that the mind is bigger than the brain. You know what I'm talking about? The brain is the physiological part, but the mind is much bigger than that. Okay, so I understand that. I get that. But it is interesting sometimes to see the physiological side of the whole big picture. And she said, so what you do if you let the sun go down upon your wrath, there's a chemical alteration that occurs in your brain. And she said, the way you get your brain back to where it needs to be, and she began to describe her process. You know what I thought to myself? She's describing the renewing of your mind. That's what she's describing. I thought, isn't that interesting? Okay, so when you and I are provoked to anger, there's a real tendency to not deal with it. But sometimes when we don't deal with it, guess what we do? We go to bed angry. I'm not going to ask you if you've ever done this. I'd have to raise my hand and admit that I have. More times than I'd like to admit, have you ever gone to bed angry? But God says basically when you and I do this, don't do this. Many commentators believe neither give place to the devil. Action is a result of going to bed angry. You give place of the devil. Now, the word place is a very interesting word. It's the word topos. Now, you probably know this from time to time. I refer to Greek words because I find they're interesting. Sometimes there's an English equivalent. And it's true in this case. We talked about Perry this morning in Periscope. This case, this particular word, topos, is found in the word topography. Okay, we could say real estate. In other words, God is saying, let not the sun go down upon the wrath, neither give real estate. Now, when we're talking about real estate, we're not talking about literal real estate. We're talking about the real estate of your mind. Now, please understand, let's not get spooky about this. I don't think we're talking about demon possession or potentially demon oppression, though I think it can come from this. We're talking about giving a part of your brain to the devil in the sense that you are thinking unbiblically. And when you think unbiblically, you give real estate to the devil. And I'm going to tell you what the devil will take and do with your real estate. He will take that real estate, and he will take that and begin to attack you. And you will find yourself defeated on a regular basis in some areas of your life, wondering, how did that happen? Sometimes people do not see the connection or the correlation between undealt with pain, anger, which turns into bitterness. I could call bitterness a spiritual infection. When they don't deal with that, they don't see the connection between continual defeat in their life. Because when you give topos, or topography, or place, or real estate to the devil, he will never be inactive with you. Okay, now, June 6, 1944. How many know what happened on June 6th? Yeah. How come all the old Connor over there, he's raising his hand. That's a pretty good Connor. I do that in teenagers. June 6, 1944. I have no clue. I mean, they don't raise their hand. Okay, they have no idea what June 6, 1944 was. The largest amphibious assault in the history of military. Yeah, it was unbelievable. And you know what their objective was? This may shock you. You know what their objective was? Real estate. They wanted real estate on the mainland. Why? Because they wanted to get a beachhead. you know what they're going to do from that beachhead. Continue to repeat again. Now that's a positive example of what this passage is a negative. You know what Satan is constantly trying to do in you and I's heart? Because once he gets a beachhead, he's never satisfied with that beachhead. You know what the devil wants? Well, really, he wants to keep attacking you so you find yourself defeated in more areas of your life. Now, I just want to ask you some questions that you really have to in your own heart, or maybe just give you some application, maybe a better way to put it, to give you in your own heart to see whether or not you have given thoughts to the devil. We're going to come, work backwards in a moment. But what are some areas we can give real estate one? You know, many times people struggle with anger. It's right below the surface. You just hit them right. And many times when you work with college kids, you can always tell the angry kids because there's the one that blow up on the basketball. You realize that kid's got an anger. He has given real estate to the devil, and Satan defeats him in the area of anger. I just heard a story of a young man who, in his first ministry, he has caused a terrible problem. He's left the church, all kinds of issues. I looked at the thing, and I said, that doesn't make sense. Somebody was telling me, well, he had an anger problem in college. Now, I don't know the connection, but that's interesting to me. You know, I begin to wonder, maybe he gave real estate to the devil, and Satan is using that as a beachhead to attack him more and more and continually defeat him. But anger is an area, but Satan attacks people and defeats them on this huge area. You know why there's a lot of anger today? Can I put it this way? You know what angry parents produce? Bitter teenagers. You know what bitter teenagers become? Angry parents. You know what angry parents produce? Bitter teenagers. You know what bitter teenagers become? Angry parents. You know what angry parents produce? Bitter. You catching it? Gotta get the idea. You know what happens with angry parents? They provoke the kids to anger. Guess what they do? They go to bed angry. They don't know how to deal with it. And Satan gets real estate in their life. And they begin to bring bitterness into the next stage of life. Okay, so these are real things. How about the issue of lust? Satan defeats a lot of people today in the arena of lust, no doubt about it. Now, let's just be honest. You know, we're living in a culture where lustful senses, sensual images are far more accessible than they used to be. Back when I was growing up, pornography was everywhere. It just wasn't as accessible. I remember I went to the Chicago Public School. I was in first grade, middle of my first grade year, December 1966. We moved to Chicago, Illinois. From Durango, Colorado. You say, preacher, what's that? Culture shock. That's what it is. I mean, a little cow town of 6,000 at the time. Durango's not that anymore. A town where literally the Old West was still alive. It was on its gasping breaths, but it was still alive. I'm telling you, as a kid, I remember cowboys riding into town on the horses, tying the horses off the poles, walking in the bank with 2 6-guns, you know, talking about off and their bow leg, you know, and their spurs dangling, and they walked into the bank. Man, that's the way it used to be. And I was open carry. You know what? Very little crime in that town had open carry, if you know what I'm talking about. Wow. But yeah, I remember moving from Durango, Colorado to Chicago, Illinois. It didn't take me about a week to realize these kids talk different than they did in Colorado. Right on. I'm not talking about accent. Every dirty word I think I've ever heard, except for a few, I heard from those kids. I mean, it was bad. And honestly, they talked about pornography. They did. Those sixth grade kids, making kids talked about. But you know what? It wasn't as accessible. I know it was the prayers of my mother that kept coming across it. They basically were pretty bad kids. And I realize they came from a bad home. They were just picking up what they learned. But their depravity obviously was being fed. But it was, wasn't as accessible in 1960. But now, I don't have my phone number right now. I will tell you, friends, everybody who has a cell phone in their pocket is accessible. Back in the 90s, I used to preach on against TVs. Preaching to teenagers, you have to understand. I haven't really probably told you that. Pastor alluded to it. Probably 2/3 of the time, I preach to teenagers. So adults. And by the way, I used to not like preaching to adults. I shouldn't tell you that. I like it now. But I'll tell you what turned the corner for me. I realized what adults are. You know what adults are? Teenagers are rapists. That's what they are. Okay, so I just preach to you like I'm preaching to teenagers. It seems to work out okay. So, but in the 90s, I preached them. You know why? Accessibility. Privacy. See, all those things. And so I made a challenge. Probably, I say, thousands of teenagers I made this challenge. If you have a TV in your bedroom, never watched anything to offend Almighty God, I want to know. I made that challenge to thousands of teenagers. You know how many came? One. One guy came to me. He said, oh, by the way, Brother Ben Gelton, I have a TV in my bedroom, and I've never watched anything. I said, wow, how'd you do that? He said, easy. I never turned on the television. Okay, that'll work. Yeah, that'll work. Okay, but you know, friends, isn't that interesting? I mean, in the 90s, thousands of challenges that teenagers have been through. You know why? Because they all watch something they shouldn't watch. Why? Privacy. You say, you still preach on that? No. The problem is every kid that takes a cell phone to the bedroom brings a TV into the bedroom, and even worse than the TV. Because the internet is limitless access to film. We all understand that. And so this is certainly with the day in which we live, with Satan getting ground in people's lives, no doubt he's in this issue. It gets with older people too. No doubt about it. Okay, so that's another area. Beachhead, Satan gets in lives and attacks people in the area of lust and the accessibility of the film and those kind of things. And that's not even talking about, when I talk about the cell phone, where we could even be talking about things that aren't necessarily considered pornographic, but they're inappropriate. There's a lot of TV, movies, and a lot of media choices today that are sensual, inappropriate, and innuendos that are not, you know, God's people should be a part of. But you know, Satan tries to get a beachhead in your life, so you're not careful in what you look at, not careful in what you're listening to. So you might say, well, I don't look at pornography, but you might be looking at things hanging on that are quote unquote pornographic, at least even by a 60s. 60s pornography is now found on television movies all the time. It's just completely, we've become desensitized. Okay, so Satan gets a beachhead in somebody's life, and from there he attacks you, not being careful in what you're looking at, what you're listening to. Okay, so there's that beachhead in life. Well, there's other beachheads in life. When I talk to teenagers, sometimes I deal with cutting. 8 weeks my wife was dealing with their name. That's a coping mechanism. Really what a beachhead is, Satan tries to get a coping mechanism in your life. Anything, how do I say this? Anything that you look to cope with the difficulties, pain, hardships of life is not too much. You know, I sometimes tell young people that the greatest coping mechanism in the world is Jesus Christ. I hate to say that because he's not a coping mechanism, he's a person. But you get the idea. He's the one that, the only one that can heal the pain. Help you cope with the difficulties of life, as we talked about this morning. Okay, so how about this? There's the issue of, even something like overeating. You know, I read of a kid, 29 years old, died 29 years old. He died, he was 65. He maxed out at 900. He sprained his knee when he was 16 years old, never took another step in his life. Died at 29 years old, ladies and gentlemen. He had been on that bed. Literally ate himself into an early grave. You say, why? Well, he had a very angry father. His father would put him in the corner and scream. So his mother let food be his coping. Now, that's an extreme example. But I'm trying to get you an idea. There can be things that are in and of themselves always wrong. Or there can be things that are in and of themselves not necessarily wrong, but they become out of balance. And so we could talk about that. We could talk about alcohol. We could talk about drugs. We could talk about a lot of things that Satan tries to get people to use. But the thing I want you to see is, now there's other ways to give Satan ground, but one of the ways that we're learning here in Ephesians chapter 4 that I believe is completely up to date is when somebody provokes you to anger, somebody wrongs you, something happens that makes you mad, and God says, don't sin, but we let the sun go down upon our wrath when we do so. And we do not make the connection between our besetting sin and the fact we're constantly defeated by a certain sin and the fact that we let the sun crack. We don't see the connection. What I'm trying to do is help you see that this is what the Bible's telling you. It's saying, see the connection. Now, I mentioned before that we live in a culture that has certainly become extremely dysfunctional as a result of that. And when I'm working with young people, I have found that one of the biggest things that causes people, not all of them, but the biggest thing that causes young people to get into besetting sins is the issue of fatherlessness. About 4 or 5 years ago, I had a friend of mine who sent me a text and said, Brother Van Gelder, have you ever heard of the term fatherlessness? I just did. He said, well, you know, not only in Christian circles will we talk about this, we're even beginning to talk about it in secular circles. Very interesting terminology. But to kind of give you an idea of what Father Wounds are talking about, several years ago there was a state penitentiary that decided on Mother's Day they were going to have a promotion. So they said to the inmates, hey, here's what I want you to do. Come by the office, we'll give you a Mother's Day card, write a nice note to Mom, address the envelope to your mother. We'll put the stamp on and send it. It was a smashing success. Almost every inmate came by, got a Mother's Day card, wrote a nice note to Mom, addressed the envelope. The prison put a stamp on it and sent it off to Mom. Wow, smashing success. They were so excited about it, they said, let's do it for Father. Yeah? They said, okay, all you inmates, we're going to do the same thing for Father's Day. Come by, get a Father's Day card, write a nice note, to Dad, address the envelope, we'll put a stamp on it, send it off to Dad. Do you know how many inmates came by to get a Father's Day card? None. You know, in the summer of 2020, when rioting was taking place in our cities, I thought to myself, isn't it amazing that the real issue is not being addressed? That is, where are the fathers? Where are the fathers? In Africa a few years ago, there was a herd of elephants that was overpopulated, and they said, we've got to move some of them. And so they figured, well, we can't move the old guys because they're too heavy. We have to take the young ones. And so they picked up, you know, the helicopters picked up, able to somehow get these young elephants, and they moved them over to another section where there were new elephants. And you know what happened? The young elephants began to do things they had never seen the young elephants do when they were with the big herd. They began to do rampages. They began to be extremely destructive. And they realized that in the other herd, the older men elephants kept the younger elephants under, you know, under wraps, so they weren't doing destructive things. And when there was no more male leadership, the young elephants went wild. I think, man alive, sometimes the animal kingdom can teach us really good lessons. Dr. Ted Roberts, who has counseled all kinds of men on sexual addictions, I mean, everything you can think of, pornography being the lowest whole rank gamut of sexual addictions. In his book, Pure Desire, he said this, it's a stunning statement. He said, I've dealt with thousands of men in sexual addictions. 98% of all the men I've dealt with have been fathers. Now, that's a stunning thing. Not all of them, but it's a large percentage. And I will tell you, as I've traveled kind of working with young people, I have found that many of them, and it's not just sexual addictions, there can be anger issues, there can be other issues, drugs, alcohol, whatever, but one of the things that fuels them is father wounds. Now, father wounds are like this. I basically, maybe I can, for time's sake, I know I can't fully develop this, but I have put it out that there are five father wounds, basically, I'm sure there's more. And this is kind of original with me. I've borrowed from other people on some things, but these are five that I've noticed. Five father wounds. Number one, the anger. Morty can upload. Angry father. Now, I've been in the youth ministry for 39 years. I'll preach in 9, 10, 11 Christian schools this fall, and for a whole week. And have done that now for years. But I will tell you that the number one problem our team deals with, the number one problem we will counsel this fall, you know what it's going to be? The number one problem among bitter teenagers, you know what it's going to be? That's the big issue. A lot of these kids come very bitter. Now, in some cases, the mother's angry with them. But a large percentage of it is the father. And the angry father says things that can be defining. You ever dealt with a man who's 34 years old? And you start talking about their father, and they get weak. That's what's a father. And many times men are absolutely defined by things that dad said in his anger. Things like, you can't do anything right. You're never enough. They'll never make it. And those things literally define them. I, without apology, say to teenagers, do not be defined by the angry words of your father when Satan is yanking his chain, but be defined by the words of your heavenly father who says, yeah, I have loved you. You've got to understand. I know that I wouldn't have preached that 30 years ago, but it's a different thing. And these young people many times are being defined by things they shouldn't be defined by. The angry father. Now, the absent father, that's pretty obvious. This is the guy who lies. This is the guy who says, I'm out of here. And he He's not, he, how do I say this? He not only leaves the kids physically, he leaves psychologically, emotionally. He's gone. How do I say this? They know. They may spend time with him, but they know. We're not on any priorities. We're not high on his priorities. A lot of absent fathers. A lot of absent fathers. Absent fathers are tough. Not about absent fathers. I have a dear friend of mine, 5 years old, that walked out the door. Well, he did come back. He did come back to get this. God. And every time he came back, this guy, I said, he's a little boy. He said, every memory of my father after he left was one. Deep father. He's the guy who texted me and said, you ever heard of his father wounds? He has really grappled with the father wounds of the absent. He walked out of the door. Now, that brings us to the third one. Passive father. Passive father is the father who stays. But he doesn't parent. He's in the home, but he's not a father. And the passive father is real. I was preaching several years ago out west when I was done preaching. The pastor was 4 years older than I, got up and had kids. It's a congregation. And he said, I gotta tell you something. I realized something this morning I've never realized before. Bitter. He said, don't get me wrong, my dad provided every need I had. My dad was more faithful. He never missed work. He said, my dad never engaged me in the father's home. He said, my dad would come home from work. This is so 60s and 70s, please understand this. But my dad could come home from work. My mom would serve him dinner at the television. He'd turn on the television, grab his newspaper. You didn't bother me. He said, my dad never took a position. I never had one father's home. He said, to be honest with you, that I realized this morning. He had tears in his eyes. His dad was long gone. I believed to heaven. I believe he was a believer. But that's the path. Then you've got the permissive. The permissive father is the father who is sometimes a good father. He just has one major problem with his thing. Never says no. The Bible has a really stunning example of the permissive father. Eli. The Bible says his sons made themselves vile and he restrained them not. Now he never said no. Several years ago, I was walking out of a church in Canada, and the pastor handed me a book, and he said, "You know, Brother Young, I picked this up, read it. You're an American." He said, "I think you'd like this book. It's called First Dads. It's about presidents in the United States and their parents." I said, "Yeah, I'd be really interested." So I took it and read the book. Didn't deal with every president, dealt with a lot of them. But it was very interesting. The book basically had a premise. The premise is this. If a man is a good president, he's a bad father. And if he's a good father, he's not that great of a president. Basically, the premise of the work is this. You cannot be a good father if the president of the United States is a good father. Interesting premise, isn't it? And to be honest with you, he said there's a lot of tragedies. I'll be honest with you, I'd rather raise my kids right than be president of the United States. I think everybody's agreed with that statement. But he talked about several presidents. One of them that was fascinating to me, he said, actually was a very interactive father. He interacted with his kids. He never said no. But think of it, he didn't say no to Stalin either. You ever heard of Ukraine, Russia? Yeah, okay. Goes back because of the president. Didn't say no. Now, it's a little politics. Maybe I shouldn't say that. But that's a long time ago politics. But it has ramifications right now. So, but he never said no to his kids. He had 5 kids. You know how many marriages those 5 kids had? 19. Do the math. That's a lot of marriages. 2 of the spouses that were married to the Roosevelt kids committed suicide right after they divorced. So it was a very interesting dynamic. But they say that FDR was a very permissive. He never said that to those kids. Now that brings me to the last one. The demanding father. The demanding father is a father who only corrects. In other words, his demands are impossible. And so a young person with a demanding father only gets corrected, only gets pointed out when they've done wrong. They never get affirmed when they do that. So they reach the conclusion, I can never. I could give a lot of illustrations. My brother Wayne is 7 years older than I. He, when he was in junior high, I think it was, went to a football game there in Durango, Colorado, where Delta, Colorado was playing Durango in a football championship, state of Colorado. This would be a lower, because these are smaller towns, a lower grade. It wouldn't be the Denver schools, but they were playing a football championship. He said, that day, he said, I watched the running back, Delta, Colorado, absolutely tear the field up and broke the Colorado State rushing record. That's quite an accomplishment, even in 1960. And he said, I watched that game. You know the funny part? That running back, Dean Amen, Christian College, I did. He became, and one day I stopped and said, you know, my brother watched you break the Colorado State rushing record. And he laughed a little bit. He's a good man. So he certainly overcome what I'm about to tell you. But he told me something. He said, Brother Ben Gilman, I got to tell you a little bit about that day. He said, I'll admit, he said, I had a great day. He said, I honestly didn't make a mistake all day long. I said, he said, I was running down the sideline. Stepped out of my room. He said, when I came out of the locker room and got in my car, my dad was in the big game that day. He said, I hopped in the car and said, you know what my dad said? He didn't say anything about me breaking the Colorado State rushing record. He stepped out of bounds in the Southern State. That's the thing. That's a perfect example. Thank the Lord, this man clearly was not bitter and godly man. God's hand was like me, certainly. And navigated it and processed it and come out on the victory side. That's what I'm talking about. John Quincy Adams, to go back to First Dad, the name of that book. John Quincy Adams is such a father. Very different. He had three sons. Each one of their lives was one of them drank himself. One of them was a clown, just absolutely, just completely, never got serious about it. And all three of them. Now that's okay. So we get a little bit of idea about this. You say, why don't you bring that up? Well, because I believe we live in a dysfunctional society, and there is a lot. How do I say this? Unresolved. You know what happens when somebody gets wounded and they go to bed angry? The Bible says to give. Now we could talk about. Talked about father wounds. We could talk about mother wounds. When I first started preaching on this, I would make the comment, you know, I know father wounds are out there. I'm not sure about mother wounds. Man, that was a wrong thing to say. Every mother wound in the congregation would make sure they saw me afterwards and said, Brother Van Gelder, there's such a thing as mother wounds. That would take me another 15 minutes to prove mother wounds. But those are a reality as well. We could talk about mother wounds. We could also talk about spouse wounds. Think there's spouse wounds today? You better believe it. May I say this? There's a lot of times, you know what spouses do? They live what I call low-grade resentment. You know what a low-grade resentment is? It's like a low-grade temperature. You may not go to the doctor, but you're not feeling quite right, are you? Low-grade resentment, you know what that means? And probably in some way you've let this out. You got a resentment towards somebody. Here's some symptoms that you've let the sun go down upon your head. You have a low-grade resentment. You, how do I say this? You have anger in your heart. Or you try to stay away from them. Now, sometimes it's legitimate to stay away from somebody because they're toxic. And they have, they always are causing provocation. I get that. But sometimes, you know, there can be other reasons. Maybe a sense of getting back at someone by isolating yourself. Trying to get them back, like Allah showed them. Teenagers call it the silent treatment. Yeah. Now, I'm not talking about that. Back at you know what that is? In any case, the sun will go down your wrath. So there's all kinds of things where you let the sun go down in your wrath. And that, of course, indicates that you've given ground to Satan. May I say this? And I say this as carefully as I know how, but I got to say it bluntly. You have a low-grade resentment towards somebody, you have given ground to Satan. And I promise you, it's just like the Allied forces when they got real estate on France. Their goal was not to hold that real estate. Their goal was to get more and fast as we can. And that's Satan's goal too. And he begins to get a beachhead. And when he gets that beachhead in your life, he continues to beach. Like I said, some people don't understand why. Why do I struggle with anger? Why am I so defeated with anger? Why am I just treating with lust? Maybe you're not looking at things, but you're just defeated with money. Why am I so defeated with lust? Or why am I so defeated with a sense of worthlessness or a sense of, like, my life has no meaning? Why am I defeated with these things? We don't see the connection with the fact that we let the sun go down on a wrath, Satan is a beachhead, and from that beachhead, he tries to kill me. And it's a very real issue that there's an answer for. Now, we could talk about spouse wounds. We could talk about, how about this, employee wounds, or if you're an employer, or employer wounds. How about that? Or we could talk about next-door neighbor wounds. Or we could talk about friend wounds. Hey, it doesn't really matter what the relationship is. There's a lot of ways to get wounded. There's not a person I'm talking to who has any kind of age has not been involved. And honestly, if you've been married for any length of time, you've been wounded in your marriage. You know why? Because you married somebody imperfect. Have you figured that out? Yeah, figure that. Okay, there you go. Got one perfect over here. Okay, yeah. Yeah, you know how it goes, brother. We all have situations occur, and if we're not careful, we don't do. That's all it takes. It doesn't take doing anything, but just... And you say, well, preacher, it wasn't my fault. They provoked me to anger. That's the whole emphasis of the text. It's not that you wake up one morning and say, man, I'm going to be mad at so-and-so. No, it's that something comes along and you get hurt. Somebody says something, does something, whatever, and it hurts, and you don't deal with it, you go to bed angry. And when you wake up, you don't even realize it. Now, you say, well, preacher, I know you kind of set us up here, because I think most of us can recognize there's probably most of this room, unless you've been very purposeful about this, have let the sun go down in your wrath more than once. So, preacher, what do I do? Well, let me just say this. I got really good news. When you give real estate to the devil, he never has legal right. You do. Now, we live in the United States of America. You know what I love about America? If you don't love America, all you got to do is travel. Talking about go to a foreign country. I'm telling you, whenever I go to a foreign country, I don't care which one it is, I come back and get on American soil, I want to kiss them. As many problems as we got, it's better than over there. I was in an African country, I won't say where. We had a big, huge courtyard, the church been in the middle of a high wall, which, you know, kind of weird. The church in the middle of a high wall. I don't mind thinking that. I thought you want to be open to the community. And so I'm talking to them about it. They said, yeah, see over that wall and the other side of that wall, we own more property. That wall. Because when I looked over there, there was nothing but houses, all built up, urban, African stuff, or urban sprawl. And I said, well, what happened? They said, those are squatters. They just took our land, built them. I said, well, can't you go to court and get your land back? Not really. Once they build on it, we lost it. I'm glad I live in the United States. What do you think about that? You know what happened, my friend? Somebody, you go on a 3-week vacation. That sounds good, 3-week vacation. You go on a 3-week vacation, come back, and somebody has built a little hut in the backyard. They got a hose coming from their house, you can talk about. Got a nice big 10-gauge cord coming from their house, you know, out to the hut, and they're living off your utilities in your backyard. Do you know that you have legal right to evict them? Did you know that? Did you not say? Well, you do. You've got a Republican here. Maybe you're not if you got a blue mare. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, but anyway, yeah, you got legal right to evict. Get rid of it. Legal right to get it back. I don't know about you, I'm glad I live in a country where you have that legal right. Friend, I want to encourage you that if you have given real estate to the devil, don't throw your arms up in despair and say, well, I'm done now. Satan's got the beachhead in my life. I've already given it to him. What can I do? No, you need it back. You have legal right to get it back. Now, I want to tell you something, friends. I can see by the clock I'm not going to be able to finish this message. I will finish it tomorrow night, but I do want to set you up for something. Because we're going to be talking about some things tomorrow night that hopefully will help. But I want to just lay them out. There's three stages of restoration. Number one, forgiveness. Number two, reconciliation. Number three, restoration. Those are three separate steps. And if you get them confused, it messes with you. You say, well, let me help you out. You know what forgiveness is? Forgiveness takes you and God. That's kind of nice. It doesn't involve a person that's wrong. You just need God and you. We'll talk about that. But you know what restoration is? Or reconciliation is? Reconciliation takes you to the other person, which means that it's not always possible. Because the Bible says, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Which infers that sometimes it's not possible. Because reconciliation takes you to somebody else. It takes you saying, I was wrong. It takes them saying, I was wrong. But if they never say they were wrong, you can't reconcile. You can forgive them in the court of heaven, but you can never give them that reconciliation, that forgiveness, until they admit I'm wrong. And if they never admit it, you can't reconcile. Does that make sense, friend? Yeah, sure it does. Here's a man who commits adultery. He comes back to his wife. His wife can forgive him. She cannot reconcile with him until he says, well, I was wrong. Okay, the moment he says that, we've got reconciliation. But there's a third step. And the third step is restoration. You know what restoration takes? You know what I mean? You can do forgiveness in a moment of time, you and God. You can take reconciliation in a moment of time, you and the other person. Being honest about your both failures, maybe one mystery. In that case, of a man committing adultery, most likely it would be he would be the one with the greater issue of forgiveness. But nonetheless, there may be a two-way issue here. But you know what restoration takes? In the illustration of the man with adultery, guess what it takes? It takes rebuilding your trust. You know what? That can take 10 years. It takes time to rebuild trust. See, if we get those mixed up with each other, you can always have forgiveness. Reconciliation takes you and somebody else. Restoration takes you. With a trust that's been broken. So those are the three stages. When we had something, somebody has provoked us in anger, done something painful in our life. Those are the three things. Again, sometimes it's a two-way street, sometimes it's a one-way street. Particularly, I think, with children who have angry parents. It's largely a one-way street. Okay. So, you say, okay, preacher, so tomorrow night you're going to deal with those. I'm largely going to deal with forgiveness because that's the key. Okay? That's the gateway. There's more to be done after forgiveness, but nothing can be done until then. And so tomorrow we're going to go with forgiveness. And I want to try to be helpful to you about forgiveness. But forgiveness, you have to view forgiveness. Forgiveness is the first step so I can get to the second step. And the eventual goal has to be restoration. Though it may never happen because the other person may refuse. That's the end. Sometimes people will say, well, I'm going to forgive them. And you go do a little bit of your life, and I'm going to go live your life. That is not true desire for restoration. Okay? Sometimes it can't occur, but it ought to be the desire. It fuels the gateway, which I'm going to call forgiveness. Now, I want to show you one other verse, and we'll wind it down here. Look at it says here in verse number 31. Verse number 31. It says, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. That sounds like an impossible statement. Okay, don't miss this. And we could walk through, I think there's seven words. I could be wrong, you can count them up, maybe six, I can't remember. But anger, bad, you can count them up. Okay, but every one of those is a different angle on the holy. Malice is the idea of evil intent to hurt. Now, wrath is the idea of a volcano exploding. So they all have a little different nuance of this whole issue we're talking about. But here's what God says. Let them be put away from you. I want to just tell you something that, again, is fascinating. You know what being put away from you? It's passive voice. You know what God is saying is? You need a miracle. You need supernatural divine intervention. You know what it's saying? It's saying, you know what sets up forgiveness, reconciliation, restoration? Here's what it's saying. It sets it up. God, I need you to divine it. I need you to step in. I want this stuff out of my life, but I can't get rid of it. I need you to do it. That's what it infers. It infers a passivity in the sense that you're trusting God to do it. That step of faith, I believe, is essential. It's the doorman to the door we're going to talk about tomorrow, which takes us to another door of reconciliation, which takes us to another door. And we'll talk about that tomorrow to some degree. Well, let me conclude it this way, if I could. Let me just say a verse of Scripture. I don't have time to dwell on, but in Luke chapter number 4, the Bible tells us this, that Jesus quoted out of Isaiah 6. And in that, he quotes that basically he was anointed to preach the gospel to the poor and to heal the brokenhearted. You remember that verse of Scripture? And at the very end of it, or right kind of toward the end of the list, it says to set at liberty them. Jesus came to set at liberty those that are bruised. Have you ever thought about that phrase? I thought about that phrase and I said, that's odd. It mixes metaphors. Wouldn't you think it set at liberty those that are bound? Or it would say to heal those that are bruised? Because the idea of bruising is a deep bruise. It's like, it's not just a surface bruise. This one you really got nailed. And you got this deep, serious wound. Okay, and that's the idea. And it got us to set at liberty them that are bruised. It teaches us something. You and I are hurt. You and I are deeply bruised. Danger of becoming bondage. Bruising leads to bondage. That's the whole picture we've been talking about here. But it's right there when it talks about that's what Jesus came to do, set at liberty. I want to keep that in mind in the story I'm going to conclude. I was preaching up the conference your pastor referred to this moment several years ago. I was certainly burdened about the moral issues, just trying to try to help folks, because working with teenagers, I'm dealing with this on a regular basis myself on the team. Every week I'm dealing with moral issues. It used to be back in the 90s, it was guy group. Now pretty much that's pretty great. Most of the time now, I'm dealing with viewing issues. How do you say that? It's a little more appropriate, but the pornography issue. Dealing with that every week. And 70%, they say, by the way, of all people are sitting in church this morning. 70% of all men sitting in church this morning in evangelical churches. You know what an evangelical church is? It's a church that preaches the gospel. Well, that's broader than I'm comfortable with, if you understand that. I'm a fundamentalist, but it's including people who preach the gospel, just broader than I am. Okay, so 70% of all men sitting in evangelical churches this morning, statistics say, are struggling with sexual abuse. That's a huge problem. I personally believe 90% of young men at Bible College. It's not a small thing. The Dean of Men of Baptist College Ministry, where I serve as vice president, has said 90% of the young men who step through the doors to study at Baptist College Ministry have struggled or are struggling. Sure. It's a big issue. 90% is the first time. So this is a huge issue. So a few years ago, I got burdened about it. I thought, we got to deal with this. This is killing us. And God led me certain ways. I don't have time to go. So I was preaching several years ago, and I was going through the Bible. I was going through the motherhood and all this kind of stuff at the conference. I finished preaching, came down. Now get me wrong, Satan can get ground different ways, but this is a big way. And so I was done. Our preaching came down, and a preacher came up. This is going to shock you. This is going to surprise you. I really don't. I hate to disillusion you, but I have to tell you this. Did you know that not everybody's happy with you? Some people sometimes don't like it. I know that's going to shock you, but sometimes we preachers, people don't like what we say. This preacher, come up to me. He said, I need to talk to you. Great. Okay. And so we sat down. He said, Brother Van Gelder, I didn't come here to hear this. All this father stuff. He said, I didn't come here. Tell me about your dad. He said, he walked out when I was young. He said, I had several abusive stepfathers. And I could tell. So I'm not a very good counselor. I really don't think I am. But I said to him, the first thing came to mind, I said, do you pray for them? Never forget it. He forgot all the abusive stepfathers, and he looked me right in the eye and said, why would I pray for them? He walked out of my life. I owe him. Talk about his birthday. I said, well, the reason you should pray for them is because Jesus told us in the Sermon on the Mount, pray for them which despitefully use you. And it sounds to me that's what your birth dad did. Man, he looked like he got hit with his head. And our conversation didn't last very much long. He went home and he told me later, he wrestled with God to pray. You know what his wrestling match was? He didn't want to pray for his birth. Now, have you ever wrestled with God? Have you ever done that? Well, I want to just tell you right now, if you ever wrestle with God, you ever wrestle with God, you will lose. So it's better to lose early than late. You get better sleep that way, okay? And so he wrestled with God all the way to 3 in the morning. At 3 in the morning, you know what he said? And you know what God told him? God said, I'm going to take my hand. He said, God, I can't believe it. I just can't. He said, 3 in the morning. A part of God, people who despite believers, pray for 12 miles. He had not seen his birth dad, no business. 3 decades. No interaction with his birth dad. You know the next thing he wants to have. He said, okay, God, I'll pray for my birth dad. God only gives you one thing at a time. So you know what he said next? Find. 7 in the morning, he didn't sleep all night, I don't think. 7 in the morning, he gets out of social media and he writes it. God has a sense of humor. The very first profile that came up was his message to his dad. He had not communicated with his dad in 4 years, literally within minutes of the message. He came to the conference that morning and he came up with his mother. I know why. Later in the day, he did open it. It was a very experience. He began messaging his dad back and forth on social media, made some contact with his dad, and I called him about two months later. I just called him up and I said, how are you? He said, Brother Van Gilbert, how are you? He said, all my ministry life, he said, I didn't want people to know about my past because I felt like they were genuine. I got up at my church and said, you don't know anything. He said, I told you. He said, Brother Van Gilbert, I thought I would shut down. He said, it is. He said, I'm going down every month now to preach in the jail and tell my story. People are getting saved. Inmates are getting right to God and contacting me. He said, I'm going to just in a few days go to the foster program here in our area. I'm going to preach to all the foster kids and tell them my story. He said, it's unbelievable. You know, he said, of course, been contacting his dad. In fact, by the way, during COVID, his dad started tuning in listening to his son preach. And he's still not had a face-to-face with his dad, but he's had a lot of contact. And so I'm on the phone with him 2 months afterwards. He said, Brother Ben Gellman, he said, I took my dad off the people who despitefully used me as, and I put him on the people I love. He said, I told my dad for the first time in my life, I told him. He said, to be honest with him, it was kind of awkward, but I told him that I loved him. And you know, friends, as I close that, I'll never forget. As I finished that phone call, this gentleman in his school, he's been a pastor for 15, 20 years. As I finished that phone call, I remember he said, I know what he said. I pray. For the first time in my life, he has come to set it liberty. Ask every head bowed, please.